Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast. Welcome to Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast 9, this issue, The World's Last Wonder, Chapters 7 and 8. This story has been recovered as part of my research for my PhD thesis on vintage science fiction in Australian newspapers, utilising the to-be-continued Australian newspaper fiction database and the Trove Archive. This story was first published in the Toxin newspaper in Melbourne in 1901, which makes it Australia's first space opera, though the plot style at the time was known as planetary fiction. As many stories that came out soon after look, feel, and read like the science fiction we love today, I feel this story helped open the gates to more of what we like, and that it represents the beginning of modern science fiction in Australia, conducting textual analysis on a corpus of over 170 vintage science fiction stories published in Australian newspapers. Helped determine that modern science fiction most likely began when we started to commonly use the made-up word scientist to describe a character that represents everything we think a scientist should be, and the character, more often than not, drove the narrative with their inventions. The word scientist first appeared in what I've termed the invention opera period, when the world was experiencing the invention rush era that, in Victoria, Australia at least, took over from the gold rush era. The World's Last Wonder features spaceflight, scientific explanations, inhabitants of another world, futuristic inventions, and plausible space drama, as well as scientists that, while not initially driving the narrative, appear in the middle and add their own inventions to the existing plethora. Research has so far determined that The World's Last Wonder is also the first Australian science fiction story to use the word scientist, signifying that our invention opera era ended in 1900. Visit my blog at www.neilhogan.com to read how textual analysis of early newspaper fiction enabled the identification of the first modern science fiction story in the USA, serialized in a Pennsylvania newspaper from April 1892, then later serialized in Australia in a Melbourne newspaper from June 1892, and now nail-biting drama as the crew of the Pioneer connect with the crew of the Annexator in their space cars on the way to Mars. This is the first appearance of a rudimentary airlock in an Australian science fiction story. But I won't give any more away. Enjoy.
The World's Last Wonder. Chapter 7. Was the Annexator freighted with the living or the dead? It was young Riva who, with all his thoughts fixed upon Alice Beston, first propounded the appalling question. He had borne up bravely against his anxiety hitherto, and still tried to do so, but in this moment it was easy to see that his feelings nearly overcame him. "If they have killed her!" he broke out at length, fiercely, and then, remembering that in all probability, if she had perished, they were, by the same fate, beyond his rage, he stopped short and sat down with a pale face and gazed up at me in mute wretchedness. I did not know what to do, and I do not know why I acted as I did. But some vague sentimental instinct, I suppose, impelled me to turn off our signal lights, by which the exterior of the Annexator was illuminated. I was glad that I had done so, for the next moment Apollo, who was still observing, cried out, "They are playing the fox! See, they are moving about inside!" And in fact, now that the glare from our lamps had been shut off, it was evident from the irregular darkening of the ends of the Annexator's observation tubes that some person or persons must be moving about within the car. I looked instantly at Fred. The sudden relief had thrown him into an intense agitation, and he was struggling hard to recover his composure. I quietly touched his hand with mine. He grasped it. Not a word was said, but his look conveyed to me the fact that, half ashamed of the momentary exhibition of his emotion, he was grateful for the token that I had in some measure shared it with him. The isolation of mere company had given place to the fortifying sense of a heartfelt comradeship. A small matter, perhaps, in the broad communion of Earth life, but in the narrow confines of our car world, amidst the oppressive solitude of space, more to us human exiles than it is easy to describe. Apollo was of a different temperament, abounding in goodwill and always ready to go of his way in order to do a good turn. He had nevertheless no sentiments, no feelings, no emotions, except for his inventions and himself as their inventor. There was nothing human about him. He was a machine himself, so to speak. Even in that supreme moment when he was ready to hurl the car and himself to destruction rather than prolong the havoc it was supposed we were occasioning to mankind, it was with the air of one who has resolved that if 7 be subtracted from 12, he will put down the remainder as 5. And out of his really enormous circle of acquaintances, there was not one who did not feel him a stranger. In his company one was, as it were, alone with a book. Between him and the rest of the world, there was, it seemed, a great gulf fixed, across which his secret spirit communed with itself alone. It was terrible, out there in the worldless void, all those long weeks of the awful journey. It was worse than utter loneliness. It was as if one had for companion some strange monster from one of those outer planets, a creature of enchantment, a moving statue in human form with an encyclopedia in its head. But for Fred Rivers' presence, I verily believe this Sphinx companionship would have made me insane. And you will now understand why I have made so much of this little incident. That night, I count the nights by the periods of slumber only, for within the car the artificial brightness never ceased, and without, the piebald sparkling gloom of space was eternal. That night I and Apollo, for even he was in this a mere ordinary mortal, were weary with long waking, and River, who had slept since either of us, kept watch whilst we snatched a brief repose. He was instructed to flash the signal lamps occasionally, in order that the outside of the annexator might be carefully examined, for we did not know what devices she might be fitted with, and it was possible that whilst ignoring our signals, her crew might be making ready some apparatus designed for an attack. I was presently aroused by a shout from Fred. He called out that signals were coming from the annexator. I sprang up to observe, and at first could see nothing of the sort, but quickly noticed that one of the observation tube ends of that car was fitfully darkened at short but unequal intervals. It dawned upon me that the uneven periods of illumination were intended to represent the dots and dashes of the telegraph code, and I reached for a pencil and paper to mark them down for deciphering. But Fred, who, like many of his nationality, was just as familiar with the code as with the ordinary alphabet, read the flashes as they came, and cut my purpose short by detailing the message. It was, "Do you understand?" At once Fred flashed back, "Yes." For a moment or two there was nothing further, and then the signalling from the tube began afresh. "Don't use lamp," came the words this time. "Use window like this." "It is Alice," exclaimed Fred. "I know. She wants to tell us that she is a prisoner." And he began signalling through the observation tube nearest his hand a rapid message into which I did not think it necessary to inquire. After some interchange of signals, he turned towards me and said, "Yes, it is. What can I tell her?" "Tell her," I said, "to have patience and bear up till we reach land. It will be on the planet Mars, and we will try to do something. But chiefly tell her to be careful that she drops no hint of your being with us, or nobody can answer for what Fisher may do with her. Tell her, when she signals you in future, to be prudent and not let her messages be seen, and not to do it too often, lest she should be observed unawares. You too be careful," I added, "and remember that if it is too much for both of you to refrain from exchanging a few words now and again, it will be wise to content yourselves with such conversation as would be natural for strangers, in case by any mischance the signals of one or the other should be read by your enemies." In giving this caution, I naturally based it on the supposition that all the rest of the annexator party were alike unscrupulous, a conclusion which appeared obvious from the consideration that otherwise they would not have consented to allow the car on its journey until the girl had been released. This, however, was an error which arose very simply, Alice Beston being under the impression that as a matter of course all four must have been privy to her abduction, had avoided the subject altogether, and thus allowed the two scientific members of the party to remain under the impression which Arcturus G. Fisher adroitly conveyed them, that she had been admitted to the car as a special favor, a practical commentary on the value of circumstantial evidence. However, it is possible that the caution may have had good results, and at any rate it did no harm. Of course, I did not learn the fact that I have just stated concerning the scientific members just then, nor for a good while after. Consequently, their immediate conduct fairly staggered me by its apparent ineffable cool cheek. It appears, as a matter of fact, though I did not know it at the time, that all the while when we had been making signals and getting no answer, the two scientists were asleep, and Fisher and Sir Mark Solomon were so utterly stupefied at beholding the pioneer alongside, signaling, that they held a long consultation together without wakening their slumbering companions. Eventually, they decided to leave the latter to discover the pioneer for themselves and await further developments. The discovery was made by McNichol Dazzler, who, upon rising and going to inspect his instruments, remarked that there were recorded upon them several extraordinarily characterized pulsations of energy, the source of which did not appear to be in the Sun, Earth, or Mars, and which he therefore feared might herald the passage of a comet or a dense meteor swarm. Hastily awakening his colleague, he drew the latter's attention to the indications, whereupon Edgerson Drought proceeded to scan the suggested regions of the heavens in search of some unknown body. He promptly discovered the tube lights of the Pioneer and, from their motion, concluded that they were a mirage or reflection of those of the Annexator upon some comet's tail. Dazzler was pondering over this theory, when suddenly Apollo, who had just got up, turned our signal lights on, and the nature of the Pioneer was thereby made manifest. Yet the possibility of there being another radio motor car hailing from the Earth did not enter the mind of either scientist. Drought was simply mystified, whilst Dazzler, on the contrary, boldly maintained that we were inhabitants of Mars and eagerly flashed the Annexator's signal lights in return. To his surprise, he got back more signals in answer, spelling out in good English, "Who goes there?" It was Apollo's policy to pretend utter ignorance of the fact that his invention had been pirated. The Annexator of New York, USA, Earth, McNichol Dazzler, electrician in command, owners on board, and who the almighty blazes are you? The Pioneer, Melbourne, Australia, Apollo Jones, inventor, designer, and builder in command, sighted you as you passed the moon. It was then that the thing occurred which staggered me. Dazzler, signing for himself and Drought, signaled back, "Glad to meet you. We'll cheerfully exchange observations. Have you any books or newspapers on board? If so, send them over, and we will send you some American magazines." "Tell us how," answered Apollo coolly. "Easy." "Maybe, but I didn't expect to have occasion for a traveling post office, so didn't study how to provide for it. Indeed, the difficulties in the way appeared to be absolutely insurmountable. We could eject waste. At that height it did not fall, but, obeying the gravitative affinity exerted between it and the car, simply clung under the bottom. But we could not reach, or even merely forcibly throw anything out, much less take anything in, without opening both valves of the escape trap at once, and thereby letting the whole of our atmosphere rush out into the vacuum of space, whereby we should be burst asunder and suffer a horrible death of mutilation, before even having time to perish from the want of air. Nevertheless, the exchange of mails was actually effected, but how the stupendous feat was accomplished I must reserve for the next chapter. Chapter 8. When McNichol Dazzler suggested an exchange of literature between the two cars, the apparent cool cheek of the proposal coming from an officer of the Annexator to us, and the colossal imperturbability of Apollo in receiving it just as if it proceeded from any ordinary strangers with whom we could reasonably set going a friendly intercourse, were even less astounding to me than the proposal itself taken seriously, as it was evidently meant to be taken. Out there in mid-space, the two cars were isolated from each other by a deadly vacuum that compelled all apertures to be kept rigorously sealed up. To open either car for a moment would entail a horrifying death upon its occupants, whom the suction, produced by the sudden escape of the air, would burst asunder or turn inside out. There was, of course, a trap for the discharge of waste substances, but that was provided with two valves, only one of them being opened at a time, so that there could be no more air lost than was enclosed between them. And although the elasticity of this sacrificed quantity of air shot the waste clear of the passage, yet the discharged substances did not travel away from the preponderating gravity sphere of the car, and so fell back on its bottom instead of falling in the opposite direction towards the earth. How it was possible with only such an arrangement to either dispatch or receive parcels, I could not imagine. And yet, as I have already indicated, the seemingly impossible feat was in a very few minutes accomplished. In reporting this, I must give the credit of the performance to Dazzler, although, to be sure, his ingenuity would have been in vain had it not been for the perfection of the steering apparatus invented by Apollo, with which both cars were fitted. It must be mentioned that a radio motor car is built on a double-ended pattern so that it does not have to turn round in space when passing from the gravity domain of one planet into that of another. Such a turning would produce a long-continued rotation, or at least swaying, which would interfere with the effective direction of the force and lead possibly to a fatal accident. The practical desideratum of having a bottom end carrying the greater weight is met by a transfer of the loading from one end to the other, when, in consequence of the growing remoteness of one planet and the growing nearness of the other, the extremity that was the top is about to become, in effect, although without changing its direction, the bottom. Under instructions from Dazzler, our car went ahead and steered into the exact line of course of the annexator. We then slackened pace a trifle until the annexator came up and gently pressed her bow against the Pioneer's stern. The upper and so far unused discharge pipe of the annexator was thus, owing to the similarity of construction of the two vessels, brought by a trifle of further steering into approximate contact with the lower and used discharge pipe of the Pioneer, the latter having been first washed, but with a little water and some chemicals. Each car carried, in anticipation of various contingencies, a considerable supply of soft India rubber, and some of this being in tube form, it was not difficult, by tying the ends, to produce a sort of sausage-shaped rubber bladder. This we did, and after thoroughly testing its soundness, untied one end and stretched it over the interior opening of our discharge trap, from which the valve, a seat valve, had been removed. The valve was then put on again after the rest of the tube had been pushed down into the trap. The lower valve, a shutter valve, was then opened, when the tube naturally inflated itself and swelled past the end of the trap pipe, entering that of the annexator, and by its expansion, sealing the joint between the two pipes. The outer valve of the annexator's trap had, of course, been thrown open to allow of this. We had now to await the completion of the process from the other side. What Dazzler did was to shut the annexator's outer valve again, thereby nipping the rubber tube and consequently resealing the outer aperture. He then removed the inner valve, seized the tied end of the tubing, untied it, and drew it in, turning it inside out over the inner end of the annexator's discharge pipe and fastening it there. Next, he released the outer valve again, and thereby established communication as far as our inner valve, which we now removed. The papers, etc., being then wrapped round a thin rod, were easily pushed through the rubber tube from one car to the other. I need hardly attempt to describe how tantalizing this procedure was to Fred, who, feeling compelled for Alice's safety to conceal his presence from the annexator party in general, was thus debarred from participating in the advantages of the tube to the extent that he cared most of all about. It must have been very trying for her too, poor girl. By way of compensation, Sir Mark and Arcturus G. Fisher must have both suffered acute pangs of anxiety, which would have been increased had they known of Riva's presence among us. When Dazzler called on them to come to the tube, They feigned to snore and to answer incoherently from the depths of disturbed slumber. I suppose they were afraid that their appearance would be greeted by Apollo with a revolver shot. Anyhow, they obstinately refrained from coming. However, Dazzler was intent on a general viva voce exchange of greetings between the respective occupants of the two cars, and so, after both he and Drought had conversed a little with each of us, including Fred, who was introduced on Fred Jackson and took care not to show himself, he called Alice to the tube. In this crisis, I bethought myself of an expedient. The tube was not large enough for more than one person to see through at a time. I beckoned to Riva, and whilst he worked off his dot and dash signals in dumb show with his fingers, I spoke, in a loud voice, questions and remarks of an ordinary conversational character to which the girl might seemingly reply. Thus, when he signaled, "Have they offered you any harm on the journey?" I spoke, "Do you find it very tiresome to be cooped up for so long?" To which her answer, spoken in order that she might not incur the risk of signalling, which, with the tube open for speaking, would have naturally betrayed her if she had been detected, would appear to be given. Happily, it was in the negative. When the questions and answers of importance were finished, the pair had the satisfaction of being able to hold a direct conversation on non-committal subjects, there being no danger in this, because the tube sufficiently disguised the voice that passed through it. Eventually, in order that their conduct might not appear strange to the scientists, Fisher and Sir Mark Solomon found themselves obliged to come to the tube, much to my anxiety. However, Apollo took them very coolly and showed himself more of an enigma than ever. "Hmm," said he, "Fisher. Ah, heard the name. Yankee Moneybags, I believe. Very imprudent to come so far from the market. Risky thing, very. Solomon? Oh, I know Sir Mark already. By the way, Mark, I really suspect I gave away too many eye-openers to you. No doubt you're riding in Dazzler's invention, but you'd never have taken it seriously if it hadn't been for what I showed you of mine. Wanted to get ahead of me, I suppose. But it's not so certain that you wouldn't have done better by staying at home and financing me. I don't suppose you've got worse than the best work in your car, and yet I have improvements of a wonderful kind only waiting money to develop them, or I should be able to run rings round you now. I'll charge you a stiff royalty when you want them, my dear fellow, in return for the capital I didn't have from you." This banter, which was purposely aimed very wide of the truth, put Solomon and Fisher more at their ease, and they expressed the wish to be introduced to the rest of our party, as the others on their car had been. I exchanged a few remarks on the weather with both of them, but fearing that Riva would not be able to control himself, I excused him by saying that Jackson had just turned in. During the next several days, the cars were for most of the time coupled together. A great many scientific discussions passed, and much general conversation, but as yet the danger of Riva and Fisher being brought into communication with each other had been averted, and the subject of the abduction studiously tabooed. It was evident to me, as it must be to the reader, that this situation of unnatural calm could not be indefinitely prolonged. My nervousness increased every hour. Suddenly, matters were brought to a crisis by a new proposal from Dazzler, namely, that as the tube experiment had been so successful at the discharge pipes, we should endeavour to apply it on a larger scale and make a passage through the main doors so that we could go from either car into the other.
It is interesting that the writer already knew that anything fired out the tubes would be attracted to the greater gravity of the space car and not go anywhere. They also knew that the gravity of bodies in space will be felt in the vehicle as they get closer, so building the structure of the vehicle with that in mind, allowing for changes in outside gravitational influence, then explaining the science behind it, is pretty impressive for 1901. On another note, the Vintage Sci-Fi podcast is non-profit. If you'd like to help contribute to some of the costs, please check out the science fiction short stories anthology book and ebook series entitled Alien Dimensions, edited by Neil A. Hogan. You can find issue number 26 on Amazon. Even reading pages via Kindle Unlimited can help. Thank you. Next issue, we'll dive into chapters 9 and 10. Expect some meteoric craziness on the approach to Mars. Thank you for listening.
Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast.